This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
I mean, the first thing I've got to ask is how many people actually watch or listen to this program in the first place? Right, so that's, two filled us occasionally. Basically what happens is we talk about rugby league on a Monday night, or as it has been for the last couple of years because of the thing, whenever we can be bothered to do it, usually live from above the wonderful Philip Howard Books in North Leeds. And today we're live in front of you. I mean, we've done two of these shows before in Wakefield and in Castleford, and now we thought we'd come to the place in the Wakefield district which has the best stadium of the three. I mean, we're all shocked that Castleford are not going to get a brand new stadium. Look at the front of the League Express this week. Trinity, no more mocking our stadium, it says there. As long as Mr. Carter doesn't listen to this, we'll be all right. Right, the panel tonight, as we look ahead to the World Cup and back at the last of the year. We'll start right at the end. Professor Tony Collins, author, historian, and, as everyone is these days, a podcaster. Next to him is the editor-in-chief, editor-at-large. What's your title, Phil?
Rugby League prostitute
Phil Kaplan. You may have heard him on Talk Sport at what, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning?
Quarter past 4, I think.
Quarter past 4 in the morning.
The slot in Pyongyang.
Next, home of the Pylons, who might play before New York. Next to him, Leeds Rhinos and England Wheelchair International on the long list for the 2022 Golden Boot. I mean, we'd have already given out now. We're fully in favour of giving out the Golden Boot for last year and this year now, but we're not the International Rugby League, unfortunately. That's Nathan Collins. Next to him, a long-time match official, now Director of Operations and Legal at the RFL, so you're not allowed to boo him anymore, it's Robert Hicks. Next to him... journalist and podcaster, also Australian, big fan of... Clubs love.
Can I just say I didn't have anything to do with the decision to postpone the World Cup? No relation to Peter Bennett.
You are the representative tonight, though.
Yeah. Derek Beaumont loves him. Any other clubs? Are you banned from Leicester?
I don't think I am technically banned, but I haven't been since they got relegated the time before last. So, yeah.
John Davidson. And next to me, the organiser of the Rugby League Record Keepers Club, which is a thing I should probably join, but if you wanted me as a member, it probably wouldn't be a club I'd need to be in, or whatever that phrase is. Neil Armstrong. So we're going to talk about Rugby League for 40 minutes or so, then have a break, then talk about Rugby League for another 40 minutes. If you've listened to the podcast or the show before, you'll know I start off with a question of our guest. Phil then asks all the questions for the rest of the 30 minutes, which saves me doing any work, which is great because I'm from Wakefield and I'm lazy. Phil, the World Cup, it's a year away. We were excited to be in Manchester last week as they relaunched the event. With 100 days to go, whatever it is. We were sold on the promise of breakfast. We thought bacon butty, sausage sandwiches, no, Danish pastries, very disappointing. First misstep from those running the World Cup. But Phil, we came away from there extremely excited about what's going to happen.
107 days since the announcement of postponement to rearranging 61 matches, 21 teams, 18 venues. They've done a phenomenal job. It was almost as if their arm was twisted up their back. They did everything they could, as far as we could see, to keep the original dates. Whether that would have worked or not will be subject to some of the debate that we're going to have. Certainly didn't look great with the Rugby Union Internationals going on at the same time. But I think there was a general feeling that because it is now going to sit between the Commonwealth Games and the Football World Cup, that this whole tranche of real top quality sport in this country or involving teams from this country, we actually sit quite comfortably. They stressed that clearly the BBC have retained their commitment that they'll show all 61 matches, and we've all so enjoyed watching Nathan and his teammates. I think that is a part of the sport we get really excited about, same with the women's game. And the other thing that they did stress is that we've now got three finals in Manchester over a two-day period, so you can actually make a huge weekend of going to the wheelchair final on the Friday night, getting drunk out of your mind, sobering up enough to go to the women's final, followed by the men's final, then getting drunk out of your mind and waking up sometime on Sunday still in Manchester, which has never happened before. Well, obviously people have been drunk in Manchester before, but no, I think we came away from that rejuvenated with the fact that they've done a hell of a lot of the groundwork, and it is no doubt all the panellists will talk about how important the World Cup is, not just as a showpiece event in itself, but actually what it could do for the sport at a time when it really needs it.
I don't think that was the official line from the World Cup: you can come to Manchester and get drunk, though, was it? Not on the record, at least.
Right, I must have written that down.
Come and enjoy the world-class hospitality, as someone would say. Nathan, you've got a whole year to prepare. Obviously, when things got cancelled or postponed around all this time, what were you feeling? Obviously, you'd built yourself up to this World Cup this autumn, and it gets moved back a year.
Yeah, obviously, frustrated to start off with when it first got cancelled. You know, we've been preparing, you know, that whole year to play the World Cup, but, you know, it's just like an extra 1% is for us to get better, and, you know, more time for us to improve.
And you've just played in a very tough couple of games against the French, who are the number one seeds, the world champions. What have you taken from those matches going into next year?
You know, they've still got a lot of good players that, you know, played over the years. Some of them have played in World Cups before, and, you know, they're class players, and, you know, they always have been. So, yeah, they're a very good team and tough opponents.
And you get to play, well, you open the competition against the Australians at the Copper Box. There's nothing better than it would be to open a World Cup and smash the Australians.
Yeah, hopefully.
You've got to play to the audience.
Well, I think the pressure will be on England, because I think in the wheelchair game they're the biggest chance of becoming World Cup winners. You know, with all due respect to the men's and the women's teams, I think them and France are the two best teams in the world. So, yeah I think winning a World Cup on home soil probably doesn't get any better or any bigger.
Yeah, definitely. Can't wait for it.
We asked Nathan there about having to wear the year. Robert Hicks, you've just hung up the whistle, although apparently maybe not.
I hung up the whistle unofficially, Richard, before the World Cup had got cancelled. The theory being that I would have potentially refereed at the World Cup and then retired. So, personally speaking, it's probably a year too late for me now. For the sport, I think it wasn't the best thing at the time. But being a glass kind of half full kind of guy, I think it probably gives us a great opportunity. There was a lot of community engagement and activity that would have been planned in the last 12 months that was cancelled because of COVID. That community activity would have transcended the sport, and ultimately that's what the World Cup has to do. It has to transcend the communities and the fans that watch it week in, week out. It has to get into new schools, into new children, and inspire people to play the sport and watch the sport that perhaps don't do it now. I mean, so I think actually it probably could end up being the best thing for the sport in this country that it got delayed a year. It certainly didn't feel it at the time, and I know there was a lot of press and a lot of internal positioning around whether that was the right thing. But I think now looking back, it gives us a great opportunity to deliver something a little bit more like what we wanted to deliver pre-pandemic. And John and his team will go through some very short-term pain, and then they'll grow again to become a fit for purpose organisation for a World Cup, which will be phenomenal. And it is, I think Phil's right, it fits in between two major international events. It's going to be an exciting 12 months. We've just got to make the most of it and talk it up as much as we can. And we need the Aussies to come.
Well, they've signed a bit of paper now.
Kiwis?
Like Neville Chamberlain, they've signed the paper.
They'll just do what they're told.
would you be tempted out of...
I'd love to referee a World Cup, yeah, absolutely. I could still technically... I'm still technically on the international panel, so at the minute I'm technically a referee for the World Cup. I would be amazed if my performances were of the level of the full-time group. They're an exceptionally conscientious group. They'll be fantastic next season, I'm sure. They'll be chomping at the bit to take my place, and I expect one of them will take my place. So I don't expect to referee at the World Cup, but we'll see.
All these. We're not blaming New Zealand, it's only the Australians who didn't really want to come over. Professor Collins, how important is the World Cup to Rugby League? Obviously, the first Rugby World Cup played in this code.
Absolutely. It was the French who came up with the first proposal all the way back in 1934, almost as soon as they started playing the game. They had the vision to say, we've got to have an international World Cup tournament. I think it's very important for the game, as Phil pointed out, because it comes between the Commonwealth Games and the Football World Cup, it puts us on a pedestal. There's national consciousness of the sport, which is something we always struggle for. For example, it's interesting, one of the things I'm doing, Mark, I'm teaching a course on sports leadership in London. None of the people from rugby league backgrounds at all. Almost none of them know anything about rugby league. They're all based in the South, most of them work in London. They do know bits about the NRL because it's seen as an attractive, high-profile competition. But when it comes to Super League, they don't know anything. So this gives us an opportunity to get into the consciousness of people who are either outside traditional, in inverted commas, rugby league areas, or who aren't necessarily aware of the game on a day-to-day basis. But I do think the thing to guard against, one of the things you find is that every time there's a World Cup in any sport, people always say, there's going to be massive interest and uptake's going to go through the roof and this is going to solve all our problems. It doesn't. When England, England won the World Cup in whenever it was, I can't remember.
2003.
Within the last 20 years in Australia, nothing really much happened because they didn't have the infrastructure in place to actually capitalise on people thinking, oh, I wouldn't mind playing this. I mean, obviously it's rugby, so maybe they didn't have that type of response. But that's the key question for the game, I think. We know it's going to be a success. We hope that that England and the other home nations are going to do really, really well. It's going to be a classic World Cup. But we've just got to keep on doing the things that the game does on a day-to-day level, but do them better, more professionally, with more good intent than what we've done. So in a sense, it's not the World Cup's going to solve anything. It just gives us a platform to get our act together on a day-to-day level.
And the World Cup trophy is beautiful. It is the best trophy in all sport, isn't it?
The return of the cockerel.
The cockerel is back.
It's a great trophy.
John, it's your fault that Australia aren't coming because you are our token Australian this evening. How was the World Cup perceived outside of this country? Could they care less? Is that why they didn't bother coming over? I know COVID's a convenient excuse for everything.
I think it depends who you talk to. I think something that people maybe don't realise, particularly Australians in Australia don't realise how insular the country it is. It is located in what's called the arse end of the earth, and people do really only think about themselves and the rest of the world, seems, because of the numerous oceans that surround it. Everything is quite far away, and also rugby league in Australia is located in essentially two states, much like the M62 game here, but it's not big in Melbourne, it's not big in Adelaide, it's not big in Perth, it's not big in the desert. People tend to think, and also I think combined with that, the establishment of Origin and Origin being a money-making behemoth now, that is the focus. And a lot of people don't worry about what else goes on. But I think Australia does actually need international rugby league. It's probably the only thing we can win at the moment anymore, because we're not very good at cricket or rugby union, or we can swim a bit, but that's about it. All right at hockey. But no, it does need, and I think rugby league needs it. Maybe rugby league needs Australia more than the other way around, but it gives rugby league legitimacy. And I think if you look at the last two World Cups, which I've been lucky enough to cover extensively, both here and over there, they're fantastic tournaments, and it does put the sport on a different scale. And I think after you have a great World Cup, people sort of realise, oh, this is great, we should do it again, and then usually nothing happens for 4 years or 5 years. But I was at the final, 2017? And I can remember Mel Meninga and Cameron Smith saying, International Rugby League is back, and England are really strong, and we've got to do this again soon. And unfortunately, we haven't progressed on. So hopefully next year we can do that and take the sport to new heights.
I mean, in fairness, the Kangaroos did tweet that they're back. You know, that last week. So, you know, they are back. It's good to see them. I mean, I did see an Australian shirt on in the background of the Celebrity Apprentice this week. So, you know, it's good to see International Rugby League on BBC One at midnight on a Monday.
Well, if we can talk quickly about the Rugby Union Internationals have been on, I think the All Blacks have lost twice in the... And the Wallabies have lost, and South Africa, who are the world champions, have lost. That gives rugby union, instead of being a three or four country sport, you know, it's a 10, gives it a lot more legitimacy. And I think that would help the Kangaroos being beaten in a World Cup, whether it was by New Zealand, England, Tonga. You know, that would be good and would probably change a lot of people's minds, hopefully, in Australia.
So we could bring back the 1997 Super League Tri-Series or whatever it was. Queensland versus New South Wales versus New Zealand. And offered that to Australia, would they probably be happy with that?
Well, I was an ARL fan, so that, to me that didn't exist. Yeah, that was a joke. It was Rupert Murdoch's fault. But I think there are a lot of insular people in Australia who only think about the NRL and state of origin. But, you know, you look at the arrival of Tonga, you know, how strong New Zealand is. Obviously, you know, England's got a lot of talent. And there are other countries, Samoa, Fiji, you know, who have improved. So it bodes well, I think, for the future of the game, and also the, you know, the women's game, the wheelchair game, and the other variants that are going to be held around the tournament next year.
If Australia didn't win two of the three World Cups, though, would they be crying for some kind of inquiry as to why?
I think there'd be. I think if the Kangaroos lose, I mean, I think the New Zealand women are very, very good, and that's kind of a toss of a coin, really, when those two teams play. But I think if the Kangaroos lost the final next year, there'd be. I don't want to say a royal commission, but there'd be a lot of teeth gnashing and a lot of whinging and moaning. It's going to be really interesting. I think they've lost two of their last four games. Someone might have informed me on Twitter. So, you know, I'm sure Mel Meninga wouldn't want to go down history as the coach who lost the World Cup final.
You might have got rid of the royal family by then, though. You never know.
They're not ranked number one in the world. I don't know why he's pretending that they're any good.
Didn't say they were any good, Phil.
10th of November in York, 7:30 kick-off, Australia, New Zealand in the Women's World Cup. I'm going to try and go to the two games in Sheffield in the morning in the Wheelchair World Cup, France, USA, Wales, Scotland, and then zoom over to York to see that, along with France versus the Cook Islands. And, you know, like, records, very important things. Obviously, on our podcast in history, there's been a massive debate, mainly caused by one person, about who should or shouldn't have a golden cap, because the Great Britain versus Rest of the World game in 1988 doesn't count. Obviously, it should. We bought him a golden cap from Wish. How excited are you about the World Cup coming? Obviously, with a year to go.
Yeah, very. I think, you know, people have already spoken about the kind of focal point that it brings to sport and the ability to kind of transcend the normal rugby league viewing public. And maybe tap into new audiences and raise the profile of the game, and I think that's really important. I think we kind of touched on it a little bit with some of the comments before as well about the galvanising spirit that things have. We're kind of seeing that from a stats side of things, from a record-keeping side of things, because, you know, to the point on what games count as internationals and all that sort of stuff, that hasn't been fully defined in the past, and, you know, there isn't, and Tony knows quite well the work that he and myself and a few others have been doing with International Rugby League and actually pulling together that kind of defined list of here are the international games and this is what people should be recognising as such. That's one example, I guess, of many that there'll be, from community games to you know, to other kind of social projects that's going on. It does become something of a focal point and a galvanising spirit, I think, when you've got the tournament coming. I was probably originally in the camp of hoping it would be postponed until next year anyway. I did think that the lead-up that we would probably have through this season was not going to be ideal to being able to do those sorts of initiatives and really gain the full benefit that hosting a tournament has. The circumstances which led to the postponement obviously were far from ideal, and that kind of left a bad taste in the mouth for a lot of people, I think. But, you know, John Dutton and co have done a fantastic job, as Phil touched on at the start, in terms of getting that rearrangement all done in such a short space of time. And it does now give us, it feels like now is the real start of a full year's lead up to the tournament, which would really allow all the benefits to kind of come through that you would hope to kind of get from it. So All of that makes for a really exciting 2022, which is hopefully going to be played in an even more, maybe we can't say post-COVID world, but a world which will feel more normal, hopefully, next year. So that can only be good for the game and good for the tournament, I think.
107 days ago, Phil, we were really angry, weren't we? We were. I've never seen you so angry. And this was over Skype, so, you know, it wasn't even face-to-face.
Didn't you write a letter to Peter Flanders calling him?
It's all your fault.
Yeah,
I adopted the Simon Johnson school of calling them cowards. Now, just on a side issue, the man from Belle Isle who you mentioned, if anybody heard him singing about 5 o'clock this morning, one can only apologise.
Was he chasing him in his dressing gown and slippers, as someone suggests he would be?
There were a lot of dressing gown and slippers, to be fair, but he wasn't one of them. But yes, if anybody did hear him sing, it's almost as bad as his normal opinion on everything. No.
How are you still awake, Phil? Because obviously you've not run 100 miles with Kevin Sinfield this morning, but a man who, of course, involved in a very famous World Cup moment in 2013, which we probably, you know, never gets mentioned when they talk about him on BBC Breakfast on the morning.
I'm fine. I mean, getting in and out of a van is not quite the same as running or cycling 100 more miles. It was just an absolute privilege to be part of something like that. And, the superhuman feat of endurance that he's done, which went way beyond his comfort zone. And we know that even doing 7 in 7, he's got an extended comfort zone that is puts the rest of us in the shade. He really struggled through part of that, but there was no way he was going to give in. There was no way he wasn't going to do it. The medical support team and the physiotherapists were absolutely fantastic. The cyclists that were with him were great morale boosters. But we talk about, I mean, it's relevant only from the point of view of the fact that, apart from the fact that I might fall asleep in a minute, we talked about raising profile and the whole thing of his entrance back into the stadium at Headingley, the way the BBC Breakfast came from the stadium, the fact that the amount that he raised almost doubled in that final hour and a half when people were watching it happen live. That's what a Rugby League World Cup can do. And no doubt we'll talk about the state of the game, but if there was one minor nagging sadness at the back of it, it's that somebody like him who can transcend the profile of the sport in the same way that a World Cup can, isn't actually now involved in the sport. And one of the other things I'm sure we'll touch on is that clearly we've got a telescoped amount of time before the next World Cup, which actually might be a good thing, because if that is going to be hosted in France, I think if you can go from what's hoped to be achieved here in the end of 22 to within only 3 years taking another World Cup in the Northern Hemisphere to a venue that hasn't had a complete tournament since 1972, which ironically was the last time we won it. That again, you've got some continuity. I'd like to hear an announcement about what we're planning on doing in 2029 with a realistic aim of actually being able to nail that into a calendar. But talking of the selfless Mr. Sinfield, who should now be not Sir Kev but Saint Kev, what he has done over the last 24 hours is what a World Cup can do. If we get it right,
you wouldn't want to be knighted anyway. I've seen some of the people that are knighted.
He's raised more money than some people who do get knighted.
Yeah, for
donate.
They
tend to donate.
They donate. Yeah, that's my theory.
That's, we're not on dodgy ground on that one. I think we're okay. We're part of the blue wall here. Allegedly. Blue wall. It's very exciting. New signings and everything today. We might talk about Featherstone in the second half of the programme. We talk about the state of the game. I joked earlier that they're going to get promoted this year, and it won't even be Super League they get promoted to. It's a Super League 2 or whatever. We talk about Kevin Sinfield there. Of course, he has played in World Cups, been part of key moments. What hasn't been seen before, to the extent it will be, is the wheelchair game, Nathan, and the likes of yourself and James Simpson and so many players who will become names that people will recognise over the next 12 months. How big a profile, how important is the profile that wheelchair rugby is getting at the moment ahead of the World Cup? So people are thinking, wow, I might go and watch some of these games across the country.
Oh, yeah, it's massive. You know, to even get our first game on Sky and BBC earlier this year was just amazing, because it's spreading the word about our sport that we've been playing, and to that get more people watching in the sport and hopefully getting them involved is amazing.
How tough is it out there? Because we hope, I mean, Phil's been to a couple of games. I was at the England-Wales game earlier in the year. The clank of the chairs, it's loud. It feels harder. What's he like actually getting out there and playing?
Yeah, it's good. You know, I don't really, you know, I'm used to the chairs smashing against each other now. You just block out the noises now, so... Yeah, it's not as tough as you think it is.
Oh, don't tell people. We're not making it out to be superheroes. This is part of talking the game down, Tony. It's great that we've got so many elements, and we've got the Physical Disability World Cup as well, which is going to be part of this tournament as well. It's going to be the most inclusive World Cup ever, which is great for rugby league. It's just something else we can sell the game on.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, rugby league was the original equal opportunity sport, because that's why it was founded. It was founded because... the rugby union won't allow players to be paid for the time they took off work to play the game. So the Northern clubs said, you know, we think everybody should have the right to play, regardless of what the background is or whether they can afford it. You should have the right to play and be paid for the fact you're drawing a crowd. So, and I think that's what we've not, the game's historically not really promoted the way that it should do. I'm sure most people here know that it's got an exceptional record when it comes to the integration of black players. You know, black players were playing international rugby in the 1930s, long before most other sports. And there's never been, you know, there's so that, you know, rugby league, it's not perfect by a long way, and it's but it's got a record that's better than other sports. And these are the things you should be pushing, because, you know, it's a highly competitive sports market out there, and one of the things that people, you know, people don't just look at what goes on the pitch when they come to choose a sport. They choose a sport that they're comfortable with, that they can identify with, where they can see themselves, people like themselves. And I think that's a big part of the marketing of the game that we should make more of, that this is a sport that always welcomes people and is actually based on that welcoming of people. In today's world, the 21st century, it's all about equality, inclusion and diversity. Well, rugby league has that in its DNA.
And I guess that's part of your role, Robert, now, is to kind of make sure that happens at the top level of the sport. Well, at all levels of the sport.
Yeah, I think Tony makes some great points about the history of the sport. And I think you're probably right. We don't make enough of our history to some extent. I think we'd be incredibly naive, though, to say we haven't got challenges in those areas.
Yeah.
And I think you've only got to look at what happened at Yorkshire Cricket recently to know that sport, I think ultimately sport generally has been born out of white privilege, pretty much every sport. So even though rugby league was born out of being a working class sport, deep down the people who created rugby league were middle class mill owners who took it to the next level. But that's perhaps a theoretical argument that's not worth debating. It's a big challenge for us as a sport, and I think unless you actually listen to people who are from those minority backgrounds, whether that be because they're gay, because they're black, because they've got some form of disability, and understand their lived experience, I think it's very difficult to formulate change. And it's easy for me to sit here as a white person involved in the sport and say, yeah, we're an inclusive sport. The reality is we've seen examples throughout the last 12 months where the sport has let itself down, and we've got some challenges there for me. I think the first thing you've got to do is you've just got to recognise that there is a challenge, and you've got to hold your hands up. I speak quite a lot with our inclusion board. Speak quite a bit with Michael Lawrence, because he sits on that board. He's an eloquent person. He understands the sport and he understands the challenges, and if you listen to his lived experience, you would not be saying that the sport was everything in the garden was rosy. So,
Absolutely, yeah. So
we've got a lot to do there. We're making progress. I think the tackle plan and the working groups we've put in place are good. I would defend our record in terms of how we've dealt with some of the cases this year, even though there's been some criticism. Knowing the full facts and knowing what we're trying to achieve, I think our clubs are on board with that. I think the more you open up the women's game and the wheelchair game, PDRL, there's all sorts of other things that are going to come over the hill in the next few years. Transgender participation is going to be one of those, and how you welcome all kinds of groups into your sport. And don't just have a policy that says, yeah, you can play it, because there is an unintended consequence that when you bring a new new group of people from a slightly different background in, they will face discrimination of some form. So you've got to help them integrate. I think the World Cup gives us that opportunity, by the way, because I think the World Cup is trying to reach those hard to tackle subjects. I think that's probably all I can say at the minute. But I think you'll see some significant progress in the next 12 months. I think that will help once we appoint our inclusion lead. I think there's an exciting an announcement coming in the next few weeks in that regard. I think we'll see some change.
I mean, at least the audience is a lot more diverse than the panel this evening. So that's one positive we've got.
And our boardrooms, I mean, ultimately, one of the challenges I will have for all our boardrooms are most people in decision-making areas of clubs are white men. There's very few boardrooms with diverse backgrounds in them. And that's a challenge for all sport, by the way. It's not just rugby league. It's a reality.
I think as Tony has said, and you said, we've always been good at inclusion on the field, but it's off the field, it's in coaching. Yeah. You know, I mean, you look at Willie Poaching, you know, sort of the first sort of Polynesian coach, Adrian Lamb. I think Adrian Lamb and Jermaine Coleman were probably the only black coaches last year. I mean, it's traditionally been a white man's profession, and that's obviously something that has to change, because if you look at the Polynesian diaspora and representation,
we found that with our disciplinary panels, that most people who got back involved in the sport in an administrative way were former white players, rather than we weren't finding players from minority backgrounds. And actually then when you start to challenge yourself as to why they weren't, it's partly because they didn't see people in those positions before. So you actually have to go to them and say, please come and get involved and change it. And we've got, for example, we took Alan Hunt on as a member of our disciplinary panels last year. We had our disciplinary review meeting on Friday, and it was a breath of fresh air to just listen to somebody else with a completely different mindset as to what some of these issues cause.
We'll talk more about diversity in the second half when we talk about the state of the game, because we'll have more diverse panel in the second half. Well, at least one person anyway. As we come towards the end of this first half of the evening, this first half, it's gone quick. The World Cup coming up 1 year's time, based mainly in the Northern Powerhouse. At least Featherstone's got trade. Right. You know, Featherstone's got a railway station. Lee hasn't got a railway station. So, you know, it's one up for Featherstone.
Has it got Peppa Pig World?
No Peppa Pig World.
I've got to go there. It's a place to be.
Be nice. They're fun in this World Cup. You know, I've got to be nice. Be nice. I'll go down the panel. What are you looking forward to most of this World Cup? What are you looking forward to most that's going to happen?
For me, probably some of the games that don't necessarily jump out as the headlines. So I can remember my formative rugby league watching years, seeing New Zealand and Tonga play at Wilderspool in what's probably now regarded as one of the great World Cup matches. That going into that game, you know, yeah, it was played at your local stadium, which is why we went, but people didn't necessarily go with any great expectations on that particular match. I think now with the breadth of teams that we've got, the breadth of tournaments that we've got, I think there's such a good chance of, you know, picking up on one of those games that is just going to kind of capture the imagination of people. So I think it's difficult, you know, you're drawn towards the England games, you're drawn towards the big knockout matches, the finals and things. But I think for me, the excitement comes in those little nuggets of games that you don't necessarily expect to be the thing that they turn out to be. And I think that's quite exciting, because that's the unpredictable element of a tournament that's got the breadth, or a set of tournaments that's got the breadth of participation and interest in it. So, I can't wait to see which of the many varied things kind of comes out of that, really.
Were you at the Halliwell Jones when Sonny Blue Williams bombed that try?
Sonny Blue Williams, yes.
That was a great moment.
Right in front of us, that was very exciting.
Well, he'd be playing for Samoa.
He's retired, Rich.
Can I tempt him back?
Have you got some money?
I haven't.
Well, I think he'd come out for a few quid. He's not nicknamed Money Bill for his lack of...
I didn't get much at Toronto, did he?
I think he did.
I'll have to talk about Toronto later. Because they're a big city, and, you know, big city Brian. What are you looking forward to?
Well, the same, I think, in the element that it's the... With no disrespect, the smaller nations, the unexpected storylines. Like 2017, it was Tonga. I think in 2013, it was the Americans getting to the quarterfinals. The Wiggles doing a song about them. It's those kind of things that you don't expect. And also, something we don't unfortunately see all the time is full stadiums. You know, that kind of big atmosphere that you only really get at Old Trafford or at the Challenge Cup final, but genuine excitement and big atmosphere that, you know, it's a big event that you want to be a part of, and I think World Cups do that. You know, I was lucky to be in 2017 in Tonga and that game in Auckland, and it's probably, I've been lucky to go to FIFA World Cups, Rugby Union World Cups, Ashes Tests, and that kind of, that Tongan, I don't know what you would call it, but
have
just
seeing...
Have you
been to Pev versus Castleford, though?
No, I
well,
haven't.
Well, there you
no,
go.
Sorry. Yeah, the people, you know, lining up hours before singing hymns. I think there was a couple who just married, they'd just come from their wedding. Like, just that kind of outpouring of emotion is, you know, is unremarkable, and I've not seen that in any other sport, whether it be, you know, Colombia v Uruguay and Brazil in 2014. So that kind of thing, I hope, you know, we get that and we can replicate that and really enjoy it.
I'm not sure you can sing the songs from Post Office Road or The Jungle at church, but that's another day. What do you look forward to as a former referee? What are you looking forward to?
I was lucky. I was involved in 13, both on the field and as an administrator off the field. I was involved in 17 on the field. I talked on your show about my most memorable moment as an official was Tonga, England. It'll live with me forever. I could name other internationals. I was in France when France played New Zealand and the Marseillais was played in Avignon, and the atmosphere of those games is indescribable, really. Unless you were in Auckland for that game, I don't think anybody will ever be able to understand how phenomenal it was. And I know loads of people say they were there. It feels like it was that I was there moment for everybody in the world, but it genuinely was unbelievable. I think you look forward to just see, if you're on the field, you look forward to showcasing your talents and hope you don't mess it up. You know, that's the main thing for you. Coming off the field, no one's talking about you. Because I was on that Tonga England game. I was with Matt Chechen, who didn't mess it up, but public perception was he did because it suited the narrative to get Tonga to the final, all those things. But International Rugby League is great because there is no partisanship. Unless England are involved in England, there's no real partisanship. So you do get nuggets of games. I was at Rochdale when Fiji played there. That was a phenomenal event. I was at the Lee Sports Village when the Cook Islands played. That was another full house, rocking atmosphere. They are just... World Cups in this country, delivered right, are always better. I think 13 was better than 17, partly because there were more full houses.
There was.
That was the reality of it. It got momentum, and people worried after that first day. If you remember, there was a double header in Cardiff. There wasn't massive crowds in. The crowd all disappeared after England got beat. And then the day after was the Sonny Bill Williams moment. And I think that was when the World Cup suddenly came to light in this country in 13. And they are the moments you look forward to. I think you're right. I think ultimately it's about those moments that you just don't expect to come in. You'll be at a game, and I would encourage people to go to as many games as they can, because they'll be at a game and it may be involving Scotland or Jamaica where there is an unlikely outcome, or it's going down to the wire, and people will understand then why International Rugby League is so important, and why I think if we don't get it right this time, we'll have missed a massive opportunity.
I mean, whatever happened in Cardiff, it was still better than Ireland versus Samoa. Was it Windsor Park, Phil? Was it just some random place in Belfast?
Yeah.
All I remember is Willie Poach and goalkeeper.
There were about 3,000 people there to open
the rain, in front of John Inverdale. It was good, that.
Followed by a game of Twickenham.
Yeah. It rained in Ireland, that's surprising.
The 2000 World Cup, the high watermark of rugby league failure.
Misunderstood. Needs
re-evaluated. We'll do that at some point next year.
It genuinely could be the reason why rugby league did take off after that. Didn't have much else to do. Had to go one way.
Nathan, I mean, this is a different perspective because you'll, you know, fingers crossed, be playing in this. What are you looking forward to most?
Yeah, hopefully I'll be playing it. You know, getting more fans in, new people watching the game. You know, broadcast it to new, like, loads more different people around the world, and hopefully winning it as well. So.
We've got to sell that game out, though, haven't we? Let's be blunt. If we don't sell that World Cup final out at what was the GMAX, whatever it's called now, that would be the biggest missed opportunity. Having seen all anybody ever talks about is if they've been to a wheelchair game, you've just got to go and watch a wheelchair game. And so if we can't sell, I mean, that would be great. If we could sell that out, that would be a massive thing for the sport and would take wheelchair rugby league to the next level. And actually, that is the... The women's game is massive, by the way. I think there's huge growth there. But if you want to be a truly inclusive sport, you've got to be able to say that we do all these different variants of our sport, and no matter how, whether you've got a learning disability, a physical disability, whether you're a man, a woman, whatever you are welcome to play our sport, and you can play at that level. I think that's the biggest opportunity for the sport.
Bespoke arena in Manchester as well. Very exciting. Phil, I think I know what your answer is going to be, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
I think there are three, if that's not being greedy. One is the opening game, because I think if we can sell out Newcastle 53,000 for England and Samoa, that's the springboard for the rest of the tournament. And if Samoa did bring the team that we think they can, then that is by no means a foregone conclusion, and it should be an epic contest. I think the opportunity to go to the Emirates Stadium is massive, because although we talked about 80% of the games being in the north, which is a mainly financial consideration, clearly to go to a new venue like that, which is earmarked to be an England game, if you could get 60,000 there, that would be phenomenal. I think a lot of people will go just to say that they were there. Could be the one and only game played there. But the other one, going back to what Neil was saying particularly, is you're always on the lookout for the game in the schedule that might give you something unexpected. Jamaica and Lebanon. I think if you're going to go to any game that's going to have the best atmosphere, where there's a possibility of a quarter-final place at stake, which would mean automatic qualification for the next World Cup, that's the one you've got to be at. If you can listen to a steel band, if you can have the taste of jerk chicken, and you can have the passion that the Lebanese have got for a fight, you've got all the ingredients there for the best of rugby league.
You know, I'd lost my money. I was going to say Jamaica Island, you'd have said, but even in three answers, out of, what, 63 games in this World Cup?
61.
I can't count. Tony, you get the final answer of the first half. What are you looking forward to most about this World Cup?
I'm looking forward to it all. I think the great thing about the World Cup, and like Rob said, 2013 I thought was the best one, is that you get a chance to see rugby league as you think it should always be. The way World Cups go, and certainly 2013 is a great example of this. 1995 is another great one as well. That's how the game should be every week. Now, obviously, it's a different thing, but you get that feeling. And I think, you know, if you're a rugby league fan, you get a bit of a strut in your stride, because things are going well in the World Cup. It's on the news almost every day of the week, so it completely changed. So it's just a fantastic experience. And I think with this one, it's even more, because it does have, uniquely for any sport, it's men's, women's and wheelchair. And I think that's something that's absolutely fantastic. And it kind of, you know, again, it just allows the game to be on the front foot, to hold its head up, and to some extent forget all the other issues that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So I'm just looking forward to it all, just melting into those, you know, that full month of imagining rugby league.
So now we've got to look at all those other issues now. We'll talk about those after our break. Go get a coffee, cue for the loser, and we'll be back in whenever we're back, 10 minutes or so. Now joined on the panel by Cersei, a former Leeds Bradford and England forward who's won every domestic honour in the game. Is that true, Danica Green?
I don't know. I've heard that too. It must be.
Did you win the treble with Bradford? When,
With Bradford.
Double with Leeds. Champions Cup.
Yeah, I guess so.
Did you win the Shield with Leeds?
Yes. Yeah.
Just missed out on a World Cup.
I mean, just as a loose term, isn't it?
I just missed out on the World Cup squad, yeah.
Oh, no, in 17.
No, I mean, me.
Yeah.
TV star, you know?
A loose term.
BBC and Sky.
Yeah, there's not, you know, you talked about the diversity of things. There's not many women in the game that could string a few words together, so... it's picked from a very small pool.
We need to find some more, though, because I ended up doing the commentary on the, well, co-commentary on the Betfred Women's Super League Shield final, in which they don't win a shield, they win a cup. I mean, I shouldn't mention that, because obviously Featherstone lost in the final.
Yeah. Curveball, but yeah.
That was good, wasn't it? Yeah,
it was a great day. It's a good day regardless.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah. And you've retired now, so, like Rob, are you not tempted to come out of retirement for the World Cup? Let's have a look. Yeah. I'm not saying you're not going to get picked for England, but Canada, Brazil, Papua New Guinea, France, Cook Islands, Any heritage with those?
Canadian. Yeah, but not enough. No, my days are, my boots are hung up for rugby league. For now, forever. Yeah, good run. A good short run. A really short run. Like you say, won quite a few bits and pieces. Played for a couple of teams. And played in a World Cup, so it's a bit of a box ticking exercise. I've picked a few.
What, being on this panel?
Yeah, I mean, this was the highlight of my career so far. It's not finished yet, so I'm going to have to keep myself calm.
What was it like playing in the World Cup in 2017? As we discussed, it wasn't the greatest of World Cups, but you know, on the field, what was it like as an experience?
I think, you know, for the women, it was massive. You know, the 13 was quite a low profile here, and the numbers were quite good. You know, Batley and the Dewsbury, it was. For the women's game then, it was fantastic. But then to go out to Australia, where rugby league is, for women, you know, is also a recognised sport and it's respected, and the women are, you know, they're seen as, you know, athletes, and they're seen as the professionals that are out there as well. So that was the difference between 13 and 17, is that Australia went, you know, had pro contracts as did New Zealand, and therefore the profile of the game was huge up there. And I think we were averaging about 5,000 per game. At Cronulla Sharks, they're all played at Cronulla Sharks, which is wicked. And the effort that they made during the... I mean, it was a very swift turnaround. We landed on the Sunday morning. We played on the Thursday. Then we played on the Sunday. Played the Wednesday. Played the Sunday. Lost. Flew home Monday. So it was probably the quickest trip to Australia I could have been on. But, yeah, it was incredible. And, you know, for the women, it's quite difficult now to look back on it and say... You know, because I know how good the next World Cup's going to be for the women and how much bigger it's going to grow. But at the time, we were playing in community fields where we had to go check the pitches beforehand for the Sunday morning dog walkers. We had to wash our own kit. We had to, you know, drive our own cars to venues and drive back. So at the time, to fly out to Australia, to have everything on a plate and to have the coaches and the hotels and all of the, you know, like everything, all the banners and all of the publicity and stuff was just incredible, and it felt a million miles away from what we had over here. So yeah, it was huge at the time, and so I'm really excited about how big, for the women particularly, next year is going to be.
Random question, Neil. Record keeping.
Yeah.
I mean, Danica's got a heritage number.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're starting from scratch on this one, aren't we? I know women's rugby league has existed for a long time, but we seem to... We've forgotten all that, because it started in 2017 this season. Everything that happened before 2017 didn't exist. So fellas, when they were good, we've forgotten that. Are there any records around? Do we know what has happened? What's going on?
I think one of the challenges with the women's game especially, and the men's game, if you go back far enough, is availability of information. Did local newspapers cover and report on games? If you haven't got that source information, local press is the main source, or trade press. Official records, is there such a thing? Not really. I don't know. Robert might tell me there's a load of archived material somewhere at the RFL, but I suspect there probably isn't. So you are relying on what's reported at the time. Julia Lee's just got some funding, which is fantastic for a heritage project to kind of celebrate the women's game, which is brilliant, and is linked with the great work at Heritage Quay and the Huddersfield University archive there. I am going to be catching up with her in a few weeks, so we'll see what we can do from a record keeping perspective there to kind of help. I think we will be able to help. There'll be some research we'll be able to do and some sources we can kind of draw on. Do I expect to get something comprehensive? Unfortunately, probably not. It's not too far back though, so there will be people that's involved. So you might expect to call Dan Hill, you might see what you've got scribbled down anywhere. But you know, typically players don't keep their own records of stuff. So you know, that you can try and tap into that sort of thing. But you're very much piecing a jigsaw together, I think, on any record keeping, but probably the women's game will be a challenge, I suspect.
Money. It's a big thing. You're obviously not being paid in your career, have you?
No.
A handful of players may have been.
No, there's not payment. There's...
Oh, that's just a story I was told about.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of stories at the minute, but there are some girls that are paid expenses now, which sounds really minor, but that's massive. You know, just fuel expenses or match day fees or whatever it might be, so that we are moving in the right direction. The women are going to be paid for the World Cup. They were paid for the World Nines. They were paid a token amount to go out to Papua New Guinea, I think.
It would have been a leg of mutton back in the day, wouldn't it, Tony?
Legs of mutton or cloth for suits. That's another way of getting around the amateur regulations.
Yeah,
win some cloth, nice. Make a suit out of it.
I would have been happy with that. It's funny, isn't it? Because, like, I don't, for me, it's that cliche thing of it wasn't an elite sport or it wasn't a professional sport, and it isn't now. And that kind of is the beauty of it a little bit, I think, is that we're willing to push the elite status and work hard for it. You know, I've retired mainly because I can't keep up with what's needed in the elite status, the training and the commitment that they need, you know, 3 times a week plus 4 extra gym sessions plus nutrition and everything that the men get, we also get it, especially at Leeds. But the expectation is that you still train up to 30 hours a week, which I just can't, with a full-time job, commit to, which is one of the other reasons where I have to leave it to the younger girls who are students and who don't work that much. it's the beauty of it, and they are working really hard, and it will be a lovely day when there are some, even semi-pro contracts going out there, even if it's just the England girls or whatever it might be, but there is something quite nice about the fact that the girls are willing to work that hard.
We said, Robert, about diversity in the first half, and I guess in terms of growing the game, women's game, wheelchair game, are the two big growth areas at the moment.
Yeah, they are. They provide a massive opportunity, really. I think because they are such untapped resources, especially in this country, I think there's a danger with it, though, that all of a sudden we think it's the panacea that it really isn't. And I think Danica's just come up with some really valid points around should players be paid? Is the women's game better than some of the men's game? There's a lot of arguments to be made around that. I think I would hope we don't make the same mistakes we've made in the men's game when we develop the women's and the wheelchair. Whether we can do that is interesting. And I think part of that links to the Women's Super League, specifically if we talk about the women's game, has increased participation significantly and has now seen a huge growth in girls' games. So that brand extension, and I think it could work in potentially in university rugby league and it could work in wheelchair rugby league, there's a point coming where you move away from being a men's Super League club, but you'll just become a rugby league club, and you may, and the most successful ones. The reality is that a lot of our women and wheelchair teams come out of foundations. They don't come out of the professional game, but the women's game, I have seen in the last 12 months, 3 further clubs move their women's team from inside their foundation to inside their performance team within their men's unit. So that is a development. I would prefer us not to look at how we pay players, but how we develop the sport such that it actually is a sustainable sport, and then eventually you can pay the players the right amount of money rather than... So my personal view, in 96, the sport failed itself because what it said it was going to do was it wasn't going to spend all its money on players, and every TV deal that I've seen, the whole of the amount of money has gone on players. Now, that's no disrespect to players. They deserve to be paid, and I know they don't get paid anywhere near the levels of rugby union or cricket or football, but if we'd have done a little bit more forethought and had a bit more foresight around some of the things we'd have done, would we be now in the same position we are? Probably not. So in 2014, when we signed our 7-year TV deal, if we'd have taken a cut of that and become our own broadcaster, would we have had a very different argument with Sky in 2021? Probably. Would you have had a chance of going to Amazon or Netflix? Well, I don't know, but Amazon and Netflix are not their own broadcaster. So people who say we should be going to broadcast companies like that and saying, come and watch it, take our sport, well, with respect, they don't produce the rugby league, and therefore, unless you do it yourself, you're not going to do that. So, and that can be looked at in hindsight, by the way, but I think you learn those lessons now when we look at wheelchair and women and PDRL. There's a lot of goodwill in those areas. There's some phenomenal athletes. My son plays in a girls' team. I think there are 2 players in that, even at 11 years of age, that I'm convinced will play Women's Super League because they are athletes. And now there is, because of Women's Super League, a girls' pathway for them to follow. Whereas
when I used to referee at the same level, there were girls who were probably equally as skillful, lost to the sport, because the game gets tough when you start playing against pubescent 13, 14-year-old boys, and they go from being 4 foot five and not really able to tackle to being 6 foot beasts and smashing people all over the park. So there is a great opportunity. I just think we need to rein back from the idea, personally speaking, of thinking that paying players will be the panacea, because I don't think it will be. I think if we build the foundations right, and this isn't great for Danica or even for Jodie, who is somebody I speak to regularly and has got a great opportunity in the job she's taken, if you build it all around paying players, it's a race to the bottom, is my opinion, because the money will not come in at the level we want it to come in to do that. And you've only got to look at sports where TV deals are on the decline to see that happening, and rugby league is one of those at the
minute. We need a consistent season. We've not had since 17 or the soft launch of the Super League. Two consistent seasons. Every season it's changed.
Yeah.
Halfway through the season it's changed. There hasn't been anything consistent. And like you say, at Leeds, we are part of the performance unit. We're going to be playing against Huddersfield, who can barely scrape a training pitch together. But they are now classed as this new top half Super League, bottom half Super League. Well, no, that's, to me, is a bad as it sounds, we've got a 6-team Super League now and a Championship again. What? Because that's what they're going to do next season. They've split it.
Don't you be taking Super League status away from Wakefield Fellas?
I think the counter argument to that would be that if you'd have left all 12 teams in a division, would you have lost a significant number of those players? Because the reality is, at the minute, there are three exceptional sides, well, two exceptional sides, two decent sides, and then four in the middle, and then a couple at the bottom who are really struggling. And are you not better trying to put them into groups where we could argue about player welfare, by the way, of putting those lesser athletes against the stronger athletes? I don't know. I don't think there's a perfect solution to it, and I don't want to sound like Ralph when I say that, but I don't think there is a perfect solution, because...
Do you know, no, there is. Do you know what it is? We've come along the elite status, which is phenomenal, and we're now... Because I think it was 2 seasons ago, we were talking about disciplinary, and we'd seen red cards in the women's game, but then the next game they were playing, and there was nothing consistent. And then we've come elite, and now we're in line with the men, but yet none of our rules, but in terms of player transfers or the things we've seen, the demise of two or three clubs this season, because we've not got... people can cut up and leave. You can just, you know, if I'm halfway through a season with Leeds, I get bored, I go sign for Huddersfield. There's no, and we're not paid, so where's the fine line between this player transfer thing? But you need to have consistent rules in order to make sure that we can build the squads, we can build the teams. And if you do want to leave or you do want to transfer, there has to be a certain time frame in which to do that, rather than, you know, so Bradford at the minute are basically saying, look, we'll offer you free PT, or we'll offer you, you know, through Jordan Lilly, because he's linked to the club. So you have to go all the way back down to, where do you want the women's game to sit? Do you want us to be in the elite category alongside the men? Well, therefore, we have to have that. They have to have the same structure as that, despite the pay. Or because we're not bothered about the pay. That's the ironic thing. The women, it's nice. Give me 50 quid for my fuel or whatever the week. You know, that'd be lovely. But nobody's actually in the women's game bothered about it. We just want the consistency to know exactly, A, that the teams are safe, so we can build and play. And B, the only prerequisite this year has been medical. We have to have a doctor at the game. So 4 games have been cancelled because there's been no doctor available.
I think that was my fault, because I was all going to be at all before those games.
Oh, well then. Well, you probably need to get a medical degree then, don't you?
I think there's two other issues, though. When you come to the women's game in a wheelchair, and it'd be very interesting to get a historical perspective from Tony on it. What we have the chance to do is, firstly, from a narrative, tell some really good stories. Mm. We're not great at promoting the personalities of the sport. And even going back to what Kevin's just done, Ellery Hanley was one of the people that was asked to comment on what he's done. And with the greatest respect to Ellery and the status that he's got in the game, he's two generations before. And whilst there are plenty of people that could have endorsed what Kevin was doing, clearly the BBC or whoever it was felt that they didn't have a big enough profile, or certainly as big as Ellery. So I think with the women's and the wheelchair, we do have a real opportunity to build personalities. Mm. Nathan's just been fantastically nominated for the Golden Boot long list. Now, the fact that he's on it, stories can be told about him now. Who is he? Why does he always play well in the big games and get man of the match? comes off the bench and changes games. You can tell a story. The backstories are great. Yeah. So I think there's that narrative, which is very important in the way the media is these days. It's really fractured. John will probably confirm that it's very hard to get stories out there unless you've got, you know, something more than they played well on that given fixture. I think the other thing is geography. And clearly we've talked about Northern Powerhouse. We've talked about, you know, the formation of the sport came out of another sport, but it was called Northern Union because it was played in the north. And expansion and or growth, whatever you want to call it, has never been successfully done, which is possibly down to lack of resource. But what we have got at the moment, which I think is quite encouraging, is a women's Super League in the south.
Mm.
And arguably there's going to be more talent in the Midlands and the south of England to call in a shorter space of time than there is in the north. I think it's the same with wheelchair that Nathan was saying the other year, that the other week when we were talking, that Martin Coyd's already got a plan for wheelchair rugby league that is four divisions of 10 teams across the country. It's not going to be restricted, because once you see it, you know, you're as likely to get a team in Bristol as you are in Sheffield. So I think that there are some really... Robert's clearly right that you can't run before you can walk. But what you have got is probably a wider canvas to paint on.
I think the challenge you've got is the reality of the sport. It created the Women's Super League to increase the number of people playing it. That was its first reason for being, really. It was born out of Sport England. That Sport England funding came on the basis of brand extension of Super League. Where are all your Super League clubs? Well, they're in the north. It didn't want to just be Super League clubs. It needed to be other existing clubs, and it helped potentially Bradford and Featherstone were both in the Championship. So I think that's the first thing I'd say. But then what it tried to become was make England great. And sometimes these things don't naturally fit together. So if you were going to make England great, do you... I had this conversation with Jodie on Thursday night. So... And was quite provocative. Do you say you can only have three England internationals in every team, so that actually the level of the competition goes up every week, so there is some level of jeopardy around results and teams that aren't necessarily... Let me explain this better. Is it better for England that most of England's team come out of the St Helens team, and therefore, bar when they play Leeds twice and potentially York twice, they don't go under any adversity and they never really struggle? And with respect, even when they play York, they didn't really... go under the pump? Or is it better that you put the talent across six teams and have 10 games which are in jeopardy, but that then reduces your argument about having a viable Super League extension brand? So when you're building something up at the beginning, you've got to understand what you're trying to do. I think at the minute we're trying too often, and this happens in all levels of our sport, repeating our mistakes we've made throughout, is we try and be all things to all people. Better not fall for the obvious phrase there. But if we can narrow down what our purpose is, I think that will help us grow. I think longer term, I think the Super League will go back together. It's got to go smaller, two divisions, to become better, personally speaking. But in 5 years' time, it might look very different to what it does now. And if you don't perhaps make some unpopular decisions, and I accept your point on regulation. I don't think it's all about regulation. I think it's also about club buy-in, and I think it's about clubs providing an offer to players that make them want to stay, rather than just being there because they're a good team. I would hope that we can, with the growth of the girls' game, make Women's Super League a 10-team competition. I accept what you say about Martin and a 10-team, 4-division thing. That would be fantastic. But at the minute, what have we got? We've got one division with probably four good teams in it. So we've got to find 36 new teams. How quickly do you get to that? Feels a bit like you've just thrown an arrow down the.
What, like Cornwall?
Potentially. We've had that debate about Cornwall today. But
I'd like the idea.
I think we weren't recording that.
I wish this had been on our league now, because I can imagine this would be a great discussion where you just go to Jody. So we're going to get rid of 10 of your teammates and spread them all around the league to weaken you, but it'll make England better.
But then, for me, the biggest thing is having a neutral England head coach. Because where's your loyalty when there's a league game where Saints are playing Leeds, and it's a big game, and you know that you want to be there for your players, but also then there's York versus Cass over here, or there's Huddersfield versus Featherstone, where I don't know. You know, the coach needs to go out and spread and see more of it, because in all reality, as good as Craig is and how great St Helens is, there's no denying that and the work he's put in there, because they are a phenomenal side and individually phenomenal players, more so really. But then where does he get to see that there are now two or three potentials going to Huddersfield, but that's going to bring up the pool there? And I don't know. You know, it's the bigger picture, isn't it? Like, I'm all for, at the minute, girls playing where we want to play, because we're not paid. You can play where you want to play, play where locationally, but in order to make England great, or however you want to do it, you either increase the EPU pool so that there's more people in the performance pool, because at the minute there's 23, 24, so basically, unless you break a couple of legs, you're going to the World Cup at the minute, because you're going to take 23 to a World Cup. Is that a talent pool? Is that a pool where you're going to go and fight for your position? Is that a place where you're going to go and learn? Or do you want to have 40 girls in there? I don't know how the men's work, how many are in the men's, but do you want to go over training with 40 where you can have four different sections maybe, or 10 against 10, you know, a couple of games against 10, and you can actually see girls play at a high level with a winger playing outside outside Amy Hardcastle, or, you know, a second row playing alongside, you know, Shani Crowell or whatever. How do you bring up the rest of the girls in the, unless they play with the higher, more experienced players? So there's, I don't know, I don't have any answers. I have lots of ideas, but, you know, it's that and all of that needs funding.
The testing point's going to be the World Cup next year, because, as Danica knows, yeah, she's played at that level. There is a fair gap between the Australian and the Kiwi teams and the growth and the money that's in the game there, in the women's game, compared to here, and they have...
I would agree, because I was on the World Cup final in 17 on the line, and that was a phenomenal game of rugby league, and was probably more physical than some of our professional men's games in some ways. And they have only gone, well, bar for the pandemic, where they made a bit of a mess of it, didn't they? They have only gone one way in terms of what they've tried to achieve. We've tried to do two things. I think we've come a long way from where we were in 17. I think we're a long way further.
The quality of the girls playing in England at the minute is ridiculous. Like, we talk about Jodie, and I think she's probably the best example of development, in the sense that 2017, she was an out-and-out fullback. And if we're completely honest, we'd hope they wouldn't kick to her. We knew that she'd be last-ditch tackle. We knew that she'd have that. But in terms of fullback skill, we were like, Joe, to be careful, someone's coming to you, or whatever. Whereas you go forward 4 years, the girl can play in about five different positions and play phenomenally well in every single position she's put in. That's player development. Where's that development come from? The level of coaching, the level she's playing with, the girl she's playing with, the standard of games, the training in England. So we trained six times before we flew to a World Cup in the whole year. They're now training every Saturday or every other Saturday.
So, and that's exacerbated the problem in Women's Super League, because if all those players are in three clubs, the other five or nine teams, however it would be now, ultimately aren't training at that level all the time. So you do get further of these blowouts. And the reality is that has an impact upon retaining players in the competition. Because if you are, and I'm just going to use the name Wakefield, and you are getting beaten every week by Saints, and then going to Leeds the week after, and then going to York, it has a negative effect on that psyche. I used to play in a team that used to get beat 80-0 every week, you know, so I can well imagine how it feels like.
Trust me, I was at the end of season award. There's no lack of team spirit in those games.
No, that's the point. They need to be in a competition that actually suits the level of the players that are there, because that will make them better, and that's why growing the women's game has to be done smartly, and it has to be done in a way that doesn't damage the sport longer term, just so that England can get to the World Cup in 2022 and have a chance. It actually should be thinking about actually winning the World Cup in 2029, probably not 2021. But I know how a sport works, and I know how a sport England works, and UK sport. If we turn around and said, we're going to bin off the 22 World Cup, we're going to bin off the 25 World Cup, they'll say, fine, there's no funding for you anymore.
When you go back to an important thing that Phil mentioned, which is, because we don't have any people or anyone knows, you know, it would have been, I guess, when whoever phoned the Pelody Hamley, so they tried to phone Martin O'Fire, who's too busy finding somewhere to plug his car into. Who is Nathan Collins? Who are you? What's your story? We need to make you a star.
I used to play a running game when I was younger, and I played for two different teams, and when I was playing, I got told by one of the teams that I was too small to play, about 12 to 14, that age group, and 1 week I was in the squad to play in a cup game, and then the next week he said, you'll be resting for the next game, and we'll have you for the week after. I didn't get called that week after, and then, didn't get invited back, so I moved teams. And then this was when I was playing the wheelchair game at the time. Once I moved back to my old team that I first started at, I played there for a couple of years, but then I just wanted to focus on the wheelchair side of it mostly. So, yeah.
And now you obviously won the double with Leeds this year, Challenge Cup.
Yeah, treble,
and,
yeah.
treble, sorry.
Leeds only do trebles, you should know.
We're all done.
We know everything. Obviously, and starred in the test series against France. When you see the wheelchair game growing in the future, we talked about how the women's game is growing, but it seems that that spotlight has almost now been thrust onto the wheelchair game in the last 6 to 8 months.
Yeah, hopefully we can grow a bit more. You know, all these TV coverage and stuff like that is hopefully growing the sport even more, so getting more fans in, if it's more fans that come in, cover to play and stuff like that. So if we can get more people in playing, more teams playing, like I said before, Martin Clench, I get the 40 teams in. If it does get to that stage, that would be like amazing. You know, more people to push us to play better at England and stuff like that. So,
I mean, the thing I've noticed about watching the games on TV and then in the arena, especially the test matches recently, the way you introduced onto the pitch with the lights off, the spotlights on you, that is some presentation. It really makes it look like a big event.
Yeah, definitely. You know, they've done it for a couple of times before. You know, they did it for the Euros in 2015, I didn't play that. I was watching it and I thought, you know, that must be amazing to, you know, sit in front of and have the cameras on you. So to do it then, yeah, it was amazing.
No pressure on you, but we'll, you know, yeah, we signed the men and women having won the World Cup, so it's all on you now, Nathan, when you think of it. So apologies, but we'll all be cheering you on. I mean, that's the one thing. And Tony, where does the wheelchair game, the women's game, sit in the vast tapestry of the history of our sport?
Well, the women's game goes back to, in Australia, in 1921, when there was a big movement to play rugby league in Sydney and to a lesser extent in Brisbane. In Britain, unfortunately, there's a great example here in Featherstone. When women in Featherstone wanted to play rugby league in 1921, they were told by the men in the game that they should go and play soccer because that's a game for girls. So in England, we're a bit a long way behind. It wasn't until the 1950s that women actually started playing, and then into the 60s. But I think the other thing to bear in mind, going back to what you're talking to Neil about in terms of records, that, you know, there were women's Lions did tour in the 1990s. I mean, this was a big thing, and Julia Lee's got a big grant from the Heritage Lottery Fund to rescue that history and promote that history and celebrate that history over the next couple of years. So, you know, this idea that everything started in 2017 is completely wrong. There's a lot of people still around who established women's clubs in the 1980s. That was, if you like, the first wave of women's rugby. And wheelchair rugby, obviously, it's much newer, but it's part of that. It's part of that tapestry of rugby league, in that people, you know, people find a way to play the game. And I think the other thing that's going on, why it's so important, not just important because, you know, it's part of making the game more inclusive, but if you look at the world of sport all over the world, then where sport is making big strides forward in terms of participation and support, it's in women's sports and it's with disability sports. And we need to coin the phrase from ice hockey, we need to skate to where the puck is rather than thinking about where we are today. And in 10 years' time, women's sport in all aspects will be absolutely massive. Disability sports will also be massive as well. So we need to, as Robert said, we need to get our structures in place now and figure out what we're doing. I think part of that is making sure we've got consistency so that people know where they are, know how the game is played, know what to expect when they start playing. And also to develop communities, because not everybody is going to follow the pathway to play for England, to play in World Cups. What happens when they decide, you know, like Denny, when they decide to retire, what role are they going to play? What role can people play in their clubs anyway? And I think this is rugby league develops, like, you know, like football as well. Rugby league developed as a sport that grew out of its communities. And the structures that grew out of that were the structures that, in the men's game, we're left with today, by and large. And so we've got a lot we can learn from the past and put the structures that learn the lessons, but are also based in communities, into the wheelchair game, into the women's game now, as it starts to develop.
I'm going to ask John a big question, but a quick one, Danica, because this is a pointed question. Woman of Steel Award, can you just name it after Andrea Dobson?
So going back to the history of the women's game, I think it's really important that pre-2017, we know more about it. Andrea Dobson is the stalwart, but you're looking back further at the Brenda Domax, Julie Lees and everything like that, and that it's a much bigger picture. So, you know, 2017, 2018, we signed, you know, Leeds got this team together, they offered us everything, we're still part of the foundation, and I've got young girls like Caitlin Beavers and the young ones coming through. It seems really menial, but in the changing rooms, you walk into your changing rooms for Leeds Rhinos, you've got your kit set up, which is just for us and for the girls beforehand, such a privilege, but the younger girls at 17, 18 at the time, it's a given. And there's no history for them. They don't know the history of the women's game, which is really sad. They don't know how hard and how tough people work to get a GB squad, to have to get an England squad, to go, you know, I have to pay to go on my first England tour. I have to pay for the privilege to go and play for my country in France in 2015, which wasn't even that long ago. Yeah. You know, and it really frustrates me that Andrea Dobson is just one of the most phenomenal people I've ever played with and I've ever had the privilege of knowing. But it's even pre-Andrea that we need to go back to when, no, the woman of steel is woman of steel. Man of steel is man of steel. It's not after anybody.
I only jumped on the bandwagon in 2017.
Maybe the Challenge Cup, you know, the woman of the game for the Challenge Cup maybe needs to be more Lance Todd-esque. But no, woman of steel is woman of steel. And it needs to, the history of the women's game is super important for the women at the minute who are playing it, who are a little bit overprivileged with what we do get.
Just don't mention Harry Sutton.
So we can contribute.
If you are, you can do whatever you want.
I feel very strongly about the history of the women's game and the people who people hardly anyone knows about.
Mm.
Way back, late 1980s, I was chair of leisure at Wakefield Council and I got some funding for a rugby league development officer. And while we were negotiating the funding, I went to watch a women's match at Halifax and I just could not believe what I saw. There was a young lass there who reminded me of Ellery Hanley in the way she played. And I went back into the council offices and talked to my officers and said, this rugby league development officer ought to be getting the opportunities for women in the Wakefield district to play. And that led to Wakefield Panthers, which ironically is now the Featherston team. But it was Lisa McIntosh.
Mm.
And I talked to people and hardly anyone's ever heard of Lisa McIntosh. She was a phenomenal player. And yet, all our history of rugby league, you try and find a reference to Lisa McIntosh, and we'll be really struggling. So that is part of the history that desperately needs Julia's Lee's work and other people's work to uncover and become part of our heritage, because players of that age, era, seem to have been completely forgotten about.
Half has not necessarily gone as I expected.
I think that's quite a common thing, though, just building on that theme. I think we're very bad at telling, yeah, no offence to Tony, but widely telling our own history and our own stories. I was on Saturday, I played in the next league tournament, and after one of the other players who I didn't really know very well, he's from home Firth, he's a Leeds Rhinos fan, and we're talking about rugby league, obviously, and we somehow got on to Adrian Morley, and he was sort of saying, you know, is he the best player, and in my opinion, the English player that's played in the NRL, and I said, well, I'm a bit biased, but I think Malcolm Reilly, he'd never heard of Malcolm Reilly, and he's a 27, 28-year-old person, and it's that kind of thing. And until a year or two ago, I never knew anything about Roy Francis, you know. And in Australia particularly, most people think the game started in 1908. So there's just so many examples of that in the women's game, the men's game. I think it's quite a sad thing that we don't, embrace our own history and celebrate the good things as well as acknowledge the bad things. But yeah, we are bad at doing that.
I mean, the good news about the future is, according to the latest 40/20 magazine, which is out now in all good news agencies,
even in Featherstone,
is that this £100 million film. We're going to get £100 million, which obviously we're not going to spend on players. If it was up to me, obviously split between Daniker and Nathan because they're sat here, and the rest of it, I'm, you know, charging my back pocket. What are we going to do with it, Phil? Apart from spending it on bad boys from the NRL?
Food for the media.
I think at the moment the £100 million is a nominal figure. I think what we can say is there is interest from outside of the game that wants to financially support it. Whether the game itself has to change a little bit to embrace that finance in the way it's governed, that's the debate that's going on with the strategic review group at the moment. Who do you bring in? Who's the partner, ideally, rather than the determiner of how your sport should be? But there is interest. The £100 million is a figure that's being bandied around, which is a nice round figure, so it clearly isn't that. But I think it goes back to exactly what Robert was saying about 1996. When the pandemic hit, Rugby League had no assets, but it was coming out of a period where it's never been richer. That can't be right. We don't own a stadium. You know, we've looked in envy. We don't own a stadium that we can get 80,000 people in and all the beer and crisps that they buy comes back to the game. We don't have the luxury to make money on the back of an international programme, which is why, unfortunately, we don't prize the international programme enough. And again, everybody can talk about restructure, what this £100 million or whatever it might be might bring, and we probably could all give an idea of what our preferred structure would be while we sit around this table and in the audience. But the truth is that you've got to have a longer term strategy than just paying the players or bringing somebody in and saying, where would you like the game to be played? It's actually not quite as simple as that, and it never has been, and we've never embraced it. I think it was really interesting the other week when Hunslet announced that they'd signed two of West Wales Raiders' best young players. To me, that's why we will never grow the sport. We can debate as long and hard as we like about have we made a huge mistake with Toronto and was that in the latest line of clubs that were set up to fail? Is there no the fact that there's no real grassroots in the Cornwall area, why at the moment are we determining to take a team there? Is the Midlands Hurricanes model where at least there is a history and tradition of grassroots in the West Midlands area and what Coventry have tried to do indeed in bringing in junior teams underneath that brand Coventry a better way to go? Do regional teams work if you're talking about feeder teams? All of this needs to be debated before you just say there's £100 million, the existing 12 clubs can have the lion's share of it, and 25 years time ago actually we didn't grow a single thing.
I mean, obviously John, what Super League needs is three teams from the WF postcode area in the top division. I'm fully in favour of that. What would you do if you ran Rugby League? I'm going to put you in the hot seat. I was going to ask everyone this, and I realise I can't ask everyone this on the panel, but I'm going to put you in the top job. You're in the top job now. What are you going to do?
As I said, I had this conversation in the pub on Saturday, and I said, have you got a few days?
Exactly the same as what happened at
there's no easy answers, there's no simple solutions. I think in my experience, and not to be a tad negative, but a lot of the issues is either with people who won't change or people who aren't willing to change, and a lot of attitudes and mindset. There's a lot of people who won't listen to outside voices or won't, don't take guided criticism, even if it's meant in a particularly good way. But there is a lot of potential there, and there are a lot of good things in the sport, a lot of positive things, but it is incredibly fractured. And the politics, it is just ridden with politics and rival egos. And I don't see that.
Don't you think that's the case, though, even in Australia?
Yes, it is. They've just
got a lot of money.
They've got a lot more money. They've got a lot more people playing the game. They've got a lot more interest.
I get that. Yep. But the game over there is fractured to an extent of...
It is, yeah.
Ultimately, whether they want to admit it or not, the NRL clubs decided whether the Kangaroos were coming to this World Cup.
Yeah.
And
the Kiwis as well.
So they're in the same position we're in this country. I just think that they've just got pots more money. And I would, by the way, I would say football's the same. So deep down, football is in exactly the same position. It's just got bucketfuls of money. Yeah, every sports ran on self-interest.
All sports have the same culture. They're all
I think. I think if the NRL didn't have a billion-dollar TV deal and State of Origin that makes so much, they would. They would look to play England more. They'd look to play France.
But the models that work are where the collective is better than the parts. Mm. So the NFL is all built around the NFL brand, not necessarily around the Buffalo Bills or the 49ers. It's built around the whole brand of that. And the NBA, and I know, by the way, we can get into World Series and Super Bowls and all that, but actually they are the only models that genuinely generate money massively. I mean, the Premier League makes money, doesn't it? We'll all accept. But there's not that many clubs in the Premier League make money. They just take what they get from the TV deal every year, with probably the exception of five Premier League clubs who nearly all went and played in the European Super League because they wanted to make even more money. That is your point. He's right. It's every sport. And actually, specifically in England, it's English sport. It doesn't make money because it's not about... You've got to make it about an experience where the result doesn't matter. But actually, deep down, our whole sport is built around our team winning, whoever that might be. And that's why we're so determined to have away fans and we're so determined to have good home crowds. But actually, deep down, the World Cup will be better because it'll pick up an event audience who don't care who wins. They'll just want a great experience in a great stadium.
Just to tack on to that and what Richard asked, and part of the problem is the history of the game here, is that at least in Australia, because of the Super League War, there was mergers, there was a wrench from that history. And there's been, I mean, there's still elements of it. There's still too many clubs in Sydney, et cetera, but there is at least a fissure between the professional game and the semi-professional game and the amateur game. While here, everyone aspires to be in Super League. Everyone has an equal say, which kind of leads to, you know, certain clubs will never, you know, Oldham, unless Roman Abramovich or someone with equal money, is never going to be in Super League.
Should be.
Yeah, well, I know you're a fan. But it's probably never going to happen. But there seems to be, well, a lot of people seem to think promotion relegation is part of British DNA and it has happened. But you can't have a salary cap and promotion relegation and competing.
And part time and full time.
Exactly. And you can have part time and full time in football where you can put everyone behind the ball and, you know, knock one over and get a second man in and maybe nick a goal and then just defend. You can't do that in rugby league. It just doesn't. I mean, West Wales have probably tried it and been beaten 150-0 not that long ago. It just doesn't happen. So it's actually getting harder, the gap.
I agree. And the more professional you get and the bigger clubs come.
In the 90s, it was probably, you know, feasible. But, yeah, it's just that gap is there. And obviously the gap, you know, you talk about the Broncos, you know, they get 30,000 people at least every game. You know, they're in a media market of 1 million people. The gap there between some of the smaller clubs is big enough. And then if you put the gap here between a Rochdale and a St Helens, it's never really going to be met. So that's an issue. We are kind of hamstrung by our own history.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the issues, though. The RFL has to do so many different jobs. You know, in reality, it administers the professional game, has to do grassroots development, has to look after students. It does everything. Whereas in most other sports, that's not simply the concern of one governing body. So it's incredibly difficult. We don't have the resources of those other sports. And, you know, this is why, you know, often what happens is it's the least worst option that's chosen. When in fact, and this is why the NFL and baseball and the NBA are so successful, it's done because essentially those are dictatorships. That the governing bodies tell the clubs what they have to do. And if you don't like it, fine, go and start your own competition. And we're not in a the RFL is not in a position to do that because it was founded essentially as a cartel of the clubs, and it's an incredibly difficult thing to do, to undermine that sense that the clubs have that they are in effect the owners of the game when they're not, because there's far more than the professional clubs play the game. But that's what the sport was founded on, and that's the difficult problem that has to be solved, I think, before we can go
forward. You can look at the NBA too and how it changed in the 70s and 80s, and then in 92 there was the NBA and the ABA. They were both struggling competitions. I can't remember who was the commissioner or whoever, but they essentially merged the two, kicked out some of the other clubs, and then you had an influx of two star players in Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and then Michael Jordan at the tail end of the 80s. The NBA became a lot more popular, a lot more successful. And then the 92 Olympics, and we can tie this in with the World Cup, international competition. For the first time, the full American pros are allowed in. and a dream team, and everyone around the world went, oh, this is amazing. And now if you look at the NBA, there's players from Canada, there's players from Argentina, from France, and they are some of the best players in the world. And the NBA is more international than it is American or, you know, purely American. So that, yeah, I think you're exactly right, Tony. And until that happens, we're not going to get a huge amount of change.
And to add to that, ultimately, each club is its own individual business.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all well and good saying we shouldn't have a club here or we should have a club there. But ultimately, if you are a member of the RFL, you are your own business. You can run your club how you should run your club. So, yeah. And that's right, by the way. If you don't do that, you get into legal arguments around shadow directorships. We've had all those arguments before with clubs in the history of the game. So it's not as straightforward as saying, oh, well, we can kick the RFL all you want. If people are so minded, I can have that argument with anybody who fancies having it. The game was built by a revolution. It's run by a lot of people who ultimately put money into their clubs. They're not taking money out of it, so therefore they have a right to have their own opinion, because they probably spend a lot more money in their club than I spend in rugby league, or even fans spend in their clubs. You know, if you could have this argument with one or two owners who would say there's two people in the sport. There's those who put in and those who take out, and the people who put in are fans and owners. The rest take out, and it's not far wrong. And then you add in the amateur dynamic that was then had a revolution in the 70s, and Barlow was born, and then it tried to come back together in the early 2000s, and ultimately having had to lead on a project that's now making the governing body unpopular. We live in a world where things cost money.
Yeah,
everything costs money. You know, you can't now go down the shop and buy a 10p bag of sweets anymore when you could when I was a kid. So the reality is the world costs money. You can't keep saying we want this for free. Oh, and by the way, we ain't going to Wembley. So the only chance we have to compete is to sell our major events out.
Yeah.
Well, I listen to loads of people telling me it's a disgrace we don't sell Wembley out. Well, with respect, we can't even engage our core audience. I shouldn't have to market the Challenge Cup final to any person who loves rugby league, because it generally is a good final, it's in a great stadium, and you can have a great day or a weekend out. Certainly the same for the grand final. I can live with an argument it's a bit too expensive to go to Wembley. But you can go to Manchester on the train for about £10, £20 return if you book it long enough in advance. You can go and have four or five pints around Manchester. You can have a really good time with loads of people. And people say, oh, we didn't sell it out because Catalan were there. We shouldn't need to have Catalan. It shouldn't matter who's there, because we have about 80,000 people who watch our sport week in, week out. They should buy all those tickets.
And that's what used to happen.
But now we've got three events, and now people split across the three. So you've got to bring in a new audience, which is that event going audience. And we're back in the same debate we were. But I listen to too many people who tell me that rugby league doesn't do anything right. But deep down, we don't even engage our core audience. And it shouldn't need me to come up with a fancy marketing scheme or say how great people are, because they should know how great these players are. For anybody who didn't want to go and watch Catalan and St Helens live and then start telling me that the sport doesn't market enough, well, with respect, have a look in the mirror and ask why you didn't go yourself, because you could get a ticket for £20. You know, I'm sorry, and I can say that about any of the finals that I've been involved in. They're generally great events, and we talk about we want to get all these new people. Well, let's get our core audience spending money. By the way, I appreciate some of them don't have money, so don't let me be too critical.
I think you're right, because one of the things that the game faces that isn't acknowledged enough is that there's a lot of objective problems. The fact that people don't have money, which is one of the reasons why people don't go down to Wembley, because there's other things you want to do, and you might not have the money. Certainly over the last 10 years, the way things have got worse. And the other overriding issue is that we are predominantly in deindustrialised northern towns. There's not a lot we can do about that. And so I agree, it's all right saying the RFLs to do X, Y, and Z, but even if it could, there are objective problems that we face that are very difficult to solve.
There are, but some of them are of our own making, like loop fixtures. For example, when the fixtures come out on the 25th of November, one of the ones that most Super League clubs fans will be looking for are Toulouse and Catalan. When are we going over there? They do find the money to go and make it an event. The Challenge Cup final has its own issues. There's never going to be a shock in it. It's going to be another Super League fixture. We don't necessarily know who's going to be in it, but it is going to be
That was why the 1895 Cup works, because it brings two clubs there who should
but
be.
But it goes back again to if there is a will and a desire to say there is a professional game and there is a part-time game, then you have to give each of those halves something that is meaningful to play for, which is something we debated on 40-20 for as long as it's been going on. The 1895 Cup and a Championship Grand Final that doesn't necessarily lead to promotion, but maybe has a big cash incentive behind it, that is the way to look after that part of the game. The fully professional side that's going to bring in your event culture audience, we haven't got the structure right. And it's not about teams, it's about how many times you want these teams to play. How do you manage to make events?
See, I don't totally agree with you, and I'll tell you why. A few years ago, I went to watch the varsity match at Twickenham. There wasn't one person there who watched, in the company I was in, who watched 1 minute of that game. They were there because it was the seen-to-be event, must-be-out event of that day in that kind of demographic. Event-going audiences don't necessarily care. It's the third time that Saints have played Wigan. You're right about fans do, but that doesn't explain why we don't get the event-going audience at Wembley.
I think we've got two specific problems at the moment. One is, how do we attract a new audience? And is that a shorter form of the game? I know that you passionately don't think so, and you're probably right. Is it making more events within the current season? But also, how do we even address and retain a core audience? We've never really had to do that. It's been assumed that they will come. There's a group of fixtures. That's what you pay. I mean, was it this week that Lee announced their season ticket prices to play in the Championship? It's going to be £25 or £27 a game. I know they may need that money to fund the squad that they want to buy, but it's completely unrealistic for existing Lee fans to be paying that amount of money. We don't engage with our core audience in any way whatsoever.
Before we get kicked out, the big question of the night, obviously, because we're in a room full of Featherstone fans. The people listening on the podcast and watching later, they don't know there's no one here, which we've talked to ourselves last week. Private Dermot, Big City Brighton, the wedding in York on Saturday, full of Featherstone fans who came straight to me and said, "You're the one off that podcast." Yes, I am not one off that podcast. You should know about rugby. I don't know anything about rugby. I don't know anything that's going on. We don't like Brian McDermott. He said, "We're a small town." Sell Brian McDermott to the Featherstone people. You know him.
If they win the grand final, they will parade him around the town.
Well, if they lose the grand final, let's stick his head on a stick.
Well, they bought him to win the grand final, haven't they? I think there's two ways of looking at his quote. One is taken out of context. He said the sport needs big city clubs, who we happened to be coaching at the time, expansion. He actually said there is a place for Featherstone. If you watch the full quote, he actually did say, "I'd like to commend Featherstone, there is a place for Featherstone, but where will the sport be in 5 or 10 years? So all he was promoting was the debate that we've just been having. I think they've signed a coach who is a proven winner, who, if they get into games at the end of the season where they need to play a certain way, a specific way, to win that match, they've got arguably the guy to do it. I do think that the Championship at the top end is going to be fascinating this year, because most people thought we'd be going to 2 tens at the end of this season and have recruited accordingly. So you've got Featherstone, you've got Lee, you've got, I think, Halifax have probably bought more players than anybody else. You've got York, who are very ambitious as well. You've got Bradford, who are the supposed sleeping giant. Now, all of those know there's a window for promotion. So a couple of years ago, they all sort of knew Toronto at some point would be going up. They all sort of knew Toulouse were likely to be going up with the way that they're... This year, I don't think there is a standout team that will necessarily be the front runners, which makes it really interesting. Which makes it very interesting. But if you want a guy of proven success, give him a chance.
Are you going to give him a chance?
Well, actually, when it was the Armistice Day, the 11th of November, we went down to our little famous war horse. I'm a member of Featherstone Town Council, and I'm also a district councillor at Wakefield. And so I went down there to pay my respects. And our CEO, Martin Vickers, came down and he brought Brian with him. Anyway, the wedding laid a wreath and I went went to thank Martin for coming, and he turned round to Brian and went, "This is Maureen, she's one of our supporters, da da da." And he put his hand out. Well, I wasn't a lover of him, to be honest, but I just took his hand and I looked at him and I went, "I'm just going to tell you now, you want my first choice." I said, "But I'm prepared to give you the chance. If you get us where we want to be, then I'll be quite happy." I said, "But don't worry, because I said, self and saints and devil power, and if it's come to Featherstone, and by the time you left, we go like that." So, yeah, I'm prepared to give him a chance, even though I did think he would have been bland and no persona. But
That's an image he cultivates,
yeah,
deliberately.
Probably.
What did he describe Gary Hedrington as that time? Well, if you could say that, can't we?
Probably not.
No. So, here's the final question then. In tribute to Brian McDermott, on a scale of 2 to 9, where's rugby league at the moment? 2 being, because he can't be 1, he can't be 2 depressed, he can't be 2 excited on 10. Where's rugby league at the moment? I'll start with the end, Tony.
I think probably about 6. We've got a World Cup coming up. Things can get better. I mean, there's a lot of problems that the game has to deal with, and it always has had to do that. But, you look at the I hate to say use the word product, but you look at the way the game is played on the pitch, whether you look at women's grand final, you look at wheelchair internationals, you look at Super League and the Championship last season, it's a fantastic thing to watch. So, yeah, 6. We can get a lot better, and hopefully we will.
Well, Bill?
I would say that we are at a crossroads moment and probably have been for the last 12 to 18 months. I think that COVID unintentionally gave us one of the very rare occasions in sport where you can do some strategy work behind the scenes. And I'm not 100% convinced that we did enough of that. I think that's happening now in a more hurried and rushed manner than perhaps it needed to. So I would say 5 and work in progress, but this is a really big moment for the sport for me. I'm old enough to remember the early 70s when this kind of debate was happening. And we ushered in a new era when the clubs were really cash poor. So going exactly back to Robert's idea of how the sport is structured, how hard it is to change. When clubs have no money, it's easier to change. And they bought in 2 or 3 people who were not the envisioned choices to take the game forward, particularly in David Hoxley and David Howes, with a little bit of John Huxley as well from the Daily Mirror doing his roadshow. Within 15 years, we were selling out Wembley for internationals. And the key for me is the international game is the first and most important piece in your jigsaw. And as long as whatever debates are going on at the moment, there is some way of elevating it, then we have potential. But I think we're at that nasal-gazing moment that you don't get that often, and we have to get it right.
I just asked for a number. That's all I have.
5.
That's like the whole of a column you've written. I mean, you must be fairly positive, don't you? Because obviously you've come off, obviously not a winning test series, but an exciting test series and a good season for wheelchair rugby. It's a spot on the up.
Yeah, definitely. We're improving a lot, and we're making like little steps, but it's doing stuff, bringing new teams in like Sheffield and done stuff like that, so we're definitely improving, like, going in the right direction, but we can always do like more to make it better.
Basically what we're saying, Bobby, we're kind of in the middle, we're above average, we're better than people say we are or think we are, people inside the sport.
So I just need to take this. RFL employees.
No, I think we are at a very. I think Phil's answer was probably right. I don't think we're as low as 5, by the way. I think we're at an exciting time, but I think we're at a precarious time as well. I think the next 12 months will be pivotal to where the sport goes next. I think the sport will exist, because it's always existed and it's always found a way to continue. But the world is becoming increasingly cramped in terms of the marketplace, and rugby league has a lot of challenges. My son told me that the grand final post had gone up because he'd seen it on Manchester United's TikTok. He didn't watch the grand final till he saw the tries on his phone. So the world is massively changing, and rugby league, I think, will evolve and find a way through that. I'm not sure it's as gloomy as people would make it out to be, but there are some challenges ahead. I think in the next 6 months, I think if you ask me that in 6 months' time, I think the sport will look very different. But if it doesn't evolve now, it's not going to be what it is, and that's not going to be, it's not going to be a professional sport. So I know a little bit what's going on behind the scenes in terms of the strategy group and the realignment and stuff that's potentially on with that. I think if the noises are right, and I don't see why they wouldn't be, I think the sport might look very different come Easter. But as we sit here today, we're about to go into a new 2-year TV deal. Let's remember the last TV deal, for all people might decry Nigel, was 7 years. So that says a lot about where we are. The international game hasn't got anything beyond a World Cup in 2022. So I'd be a liar to say I thought it was an 8, 7, 8 or 9. But I think in 6 months' time, I could easily be saying it's a 7 or an 8. And I think people will be surprised at some of the things that are about in the offing. But I think probably about a 6. I'm sorry. I think we're probably at a 6. And if you ask me in 6 months' time, I think we'll be a lot better than that. I would also say that it's very easy to sit here or sit in an audience or even listen to this podcast and say rugby league constantly shoots itself in the foot. I don't think it does. I think the least worst option is often taken. The least controversial option is taken. There's some exciting things going to happen. I believe in certain people around the sport will deliver a fantastic World Cup. And I think the one thing it never fails to do is it always excites on the field of play. And I don't think we can go back as far as we want. The grand final last year, the Challenge Cup when Catalan beat Warrington, further back to the World Cup in 17, the World Cup in 13, it produces fantastic sporting events. It'll continue to do that. But there's some massive challenges ahead. Let's not pretend there's not.
I would say with the news today on the World Cup Challenge and maybe certain player signings and, you know, having been through a few rough from a press conferences, I'd say maybe a 4.5. But if I look to next year, there's a French derby for the first time. There's a World Cup on these shores, and I'll get to see Tommy Turbo in the flesh and the green and gold, so I'll go 5, 5.5.
I think for me, I would never necessarily badge the average rugby league fan if there is such a thing as an optimist. I think other words are probably better used to describe them. The sense I get at the moment is that people are probably less optimistic now than they have been for a few years, though. And I think maybe regardless of what the actual score I would give, I think the trajectory of that score is probably the thing that's causing people more concern and has probably led to a lot of the debate and discussion that we've had a bit today. My hope, I don't know if it's my expectation, but my hope is that 2022 becomes something of a turning point in that trajectory. And I think the fact we've got the World Cup at the end of the year does give a big opportunity to reinvigorate, I think, the average fan and the average rugby league spectator and give that kind of optimism that I think people have been searching for a while, and the circumstance the world's found itself in the last 20 months or so probably hasn't contributed a great deal to people's general optimism. But yeah, for me, I'd have it in the kind of 4 to 5 region at the moment, if I'm trying to gauge, I think, where the average fan is as well. But I genuinely think that 2022 gives a lot of opportunity, as much as anything, just to bring some more optimism to the game. And if some of what Robert's kind of alluded to there does kind of come to pass and we do get some more positive stories and more positive news kind of coming centrally, I think everyone's kind of waiting and crying out for that, really. So hopefully the trajectory changes as much as anything as we go forward. I think that's what I'm hoping for in the future anyway.
As the great Sophie Ellis Bextor said, a pessimist is never disappointed. Danica, where are you on the scale? You get the final word.
Oh, mix it up a little bit. I've got to jump on the dovetails, really, of like Nathan and I have just come back from having TV coverage. We've had more coverage in the women's game this season than we've had ever. You've got household names in the likes of Jodie Cunningham and Amy Hardcastle and Carrie Roberts and stuff like that. So in terms of where the women's game is and where the wheelchair game is going, I've got to look at the positives of that. I'm a maths teacher, so I'm looking at the men's and I'm bringing the averages together. And whether it's the fact that we've got to look at parts of the game to see how great that side of it's going, and hopefully that can continue to grow and develop. I'm going to go 6.3, because I can.
That's the
maths teacher. It's a figure. And I'm going to bounce. I mean, Nathan's probably been the best year you've had for wheelchair, just in terms of coverage and being on TV. Same with the women's game. I've been on Sky and BBC this year. So, yeah, 6.3. Finish on a high, guys.
Rugby league average.
Do you not give us a number? Or do you just ask the question?
Oh, this, I'm just finished on a high now, do you know what I mean? Debbie Downer over here.
Just ask the question, all this we've learned. Some of my questions are not as good as others, and that one lasted longer than I thought it would be. Hopefully, we've passed the audition, and we do this again at some point in the future. Thanks to everyone on the panel tonight, Professor Tony Collins, Phil Kaplan, Nathan Collins, we wish you the best of luck. We've actually played in the World Cup next year. Robert Hicks, who we wish well with his new role. John Davidson, who's on Patreon. Neil Olsen and Danica Premier is on the telly. And a model now as well, apparently.
What?
All those massive 10-foot photos.
Oh, don't talk about that, yeah.
Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. And enjoy your rugby.